gentlemen, welcome to the seventh in the fall series of the Vancouver Institute Lectures. This evening I am pleased to introduce to you Sir Derek Barton, who is here as a Cecil and Ida Green visiting professor. He has a number of distinctions such that I will not endeavor to enumerate all of them, but very briefly, he received his PhD in 1942. He became a member of the Royal Society in 1954. He has received numerous honorary doctorates and been a lecturer at many institutions. In 1961, he was the recipient of the Davy Medal of the Royal Society. And in 1969, he received the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. This evening, he will address us on the classification of crises, the world today. Sir Derek Barton.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, all the new friends that we've made in the last 2 weeks, I would like to say, first of all, how much I appreciate the opportunity to visit Vancouver and also the honor of the invitation to address the Vancouver Institute. My talk derives from a letter that I received some 6 years ago now. This was a letter which had been composed by a group of social scientists who had prepared a memorandum which they wished me to sign. And this memorandum, in essence, said that the world is a terrible place. It's worse than it's ever been before. Mankind is surely due for perdition, and I'd like you to sign this memorandum. Well, I don't agree with that. I think the world has never been a better place in which to live than it is now. I think that never a higher proportion of the population has been able to indulge in creative cultural life. And that although I recognize there are many faults in our civilization and in our world, nevertheless, there's no need to be pessimistic. So I wrote a reply to these gentlemen, these social scientists, to this effect. Now they had planned to produce a book, and a little while ago, about a year ago, they wrote to me and said that unfortunately, because of the nature of the replies they had received, they were now unable to produce this book. I was born during the First World War, and I grew up during the Depression, and I survived the Second World War, and I'm still here. Now, I think the two wars, the First War and the Second War, and the Depression of the 1930s, were real crises. I remember them quite well. Not the First World War, I was a baby, but everything else I remember. I think that most of the so-called crises with which we are said to be faced are not crises at all. And I like to classify my crises. I classify them into imaginary crises, artificial crises, and real crises. And this evening I'd like to tell you a relatively short period of time what I think about the various so-called crises, but I'm not going to take too long about it, not more than 30 or 40 minutes, and then I'm going to allow all the audience to get up and say how they disagree with me, to correct me, to ask me questions, to say whatever they like, in fact. In fact, we'll have a debate. Now, until we come to the debating time, I hope that you will be polite and not disagree with me verbally, even though I hold such radical views. So let's begin with our crises. And the first crisis I'd like to talk about is the crisis of pollution. I think that pollution, the crisis of pollution, is an imaginary crisis. It does not exist. The reason why I say that is because we have already at our disposal all the technical knowledge which is needed to identify the level of pollution and to correct the pollution when we find it. The problem is in fact one of law and of the enforcement of law, and of course of paying for the cost involved. It's not a problem of science or of technology at all. Let me give you an example which I remember vividly from my own life. When I was a boy in London, we used to have these famous yellow fogs, which are familiar to you from reading Dickens or from reading about Sherlock Holmes. Now, these yellow fogs were really extremely unpleasant. They were full of sulfuric acid and sulfur dioxide. They irritated the lungs, and indeed the death rate from pulmonary disease increased markedly during the period of the yellow fog. Now, we haven't had a yellow fog in London for the last 15 years. Why? Because after the Second World War, the British government passed a law, the Clean Air Act, which said that you no longer had the right to burn bituminous coal, nor did factories have the right to admit a smoke beyond a certain minimal level. This law, after being passed, was duly enforced. And it was enforced by a body which in the British nomenclature has the curious title of the Alkali Inspectorate. And you may like to know why should a body of law enforcers who deal with pollution by smoke be called the Alkali Inspectorate. Well, that is because the alkali industry in the last century, the end of the last century, was polluting the British countryside. And the reaction against that pollution was such that the government of that time, already nearly 100 years ago, passed a law which was enforced by the Alkali Inspectorate. So pollution is in no way a new phenomenon. It's not something we discovered 10 years ago. It's something which has been with us since industrialization began. Well, as a result of enforcing the law, the yellow fogs have disappeared. And I see no difference between this kind of correction of pollution and the necessary correction that we need make to any other kind of pollution, whether it's pollution by mercury, pollution by lead, pollution by sulfur dioxide, which still remains a problem, at least in Canada, and any other kind of pollution. There are, however, some international complications with regard to pollution. It's not just a national matter. For example, in the United Kingdom, thanks to the law that I just mentioned about clean air, factory chimneys have become much taller, the object being to send the sulfur dioxide from the combustion of coal up into the stratosphere. Well, that's good. That gets it away from the United Kingdom, but it then crosses the North Sea and comes down again in Scandinavia as what is called acid rain. And it's quite true that the pH of Scandinavian lakes and rivers has been going down steadily for some 20 years. Now, what do the Scandinavians do about that? I don't know, but they must have some way of ensuring that the British and the Germans either take away the sulfur dioxide from their smoke or else make appropriate compensation for the pollution that they're causing in Scandinavia. There is exactly, of course, the same kind of problem in the pollution of the Rhine. pollution of the Rhine is truly an international problem, and those of you who follow these matters will be pleased to know that the states which border the Rhine have got together and are working on this problem and are improving the condition of the waters of the Rhine. Second crisis of energy. This arrived with us just 2 or 3 years ago. We hadn't heard about it before, I think. It is entirely an artificial crisis. It's artificial because it was provoked by an international monopoly, a monopoly of the states which produce petroleum. I consider it to be just as regrettable that there is an international monopoly as I would consider it regrettable to find a national monopoly. That is, anything which exploits the general public, to my mind, is regrettable. However, this monopoly is not going to disappear just because I say that it's regrettable, and we have to live with it. As you may know, there is, of course, at the present moment, too much petroleum being offered on the market. But because of the way the market is controlled, the normal offer, a normal law of offer and demand is not going to operate. People tell us that there's a great crisis in petroleum resources and natural gas resources, and that in 20 years' time they will all be exhausted. I don't believe that at all. Petroleum and natural gas are found in sedimentary rock. About 70 or 80% of the sedimentary rock in the world is found under the sea. We've hardly begun to explore under the sea at the moment, and I believe myself that 70 or 80% of the oil and natural gas in the world is still to be found. It will be found and produced, but of course at a price which is greater than that to which we have been accustomed in the past. Equally, there's plenty of coal in the world, and there is also an excellent German process, the Fischer-Tropsch process, for converting coal into petroleum. During the last World War, the German state survived thanks to the Fischer-Tropsch process. This process is still being, in fact, used in one country in the world, in South Africa, where they have a large plant and are presently building another one. Now, the only thing that's wrong with the Fischer-Tropsch process for making petroleum is that it costs about twice what the present price of petroleum hydrocarbons. So it's considerably above the world, real world level. But if it has to be used, it's there to be used. And I don't need to remind this audience of the enormous quantities of petroleum that there are in the tar sands of Athabasca or in the shale of the United States. So I don't really feel there's any crisis of energy, a readily available energy. There's just the question of at what price you are prepared to pay to get this energy. The crisis, if there is one, is simply a crisis of the sudden increase in price of a raw material. When the price of raw material, which is not the subject of monopoly, is allowed to increase steadily, what happens, of course, is that people work hard at finding other and alternative sources. So the price increases gradually. As the price increases, sources which otherwise would not be possible come into operation. People like to talk, ecologists in particular, like to talk about sunlight. They like to talk about wind and wave power and things like that. Now, all the studies, I think, that have been made in this direction tend to show that such sources of energy are minimal, and if they were to be used, would be rather expensive. But I think I've already demonstrated just a moment ago that we don't have to worry about these rather minimal resources. We still have enormous resources available to us, and no reason whatsoever for being pessimistic. We just have to get down and do some work. Now, I haven't said anything about nuclear energy yet. This is a very tender subject, at least in Europe, where the students are always marching and protesting about nuclear energy. And I think that they are completely misled. They pretend that nuclear energy is dangerous to mankind. It is true that no action whatsoever of mankind is completely safe. As we're not safe here this evening. There may be some tremendous meteorite which is coming from outer space and which is going to completely crush this lecture theater during the time that I'm talking. No one can say that that's not going to happen. It's just a question of probability. And my estimate of probability is that nothing is going to happen to this lecture theater during my talk, nor during the debate which is going to follow. If you really want to be concerned about the hazards of life at the present time, you should think about the motor car. The motor car is the principal killer in modern society, kills more people than anything else. We don't have to have cars. If instead of having cars we had just public transport in buses, we would reduce the death rate due to accidents, by automobile accidents, or by certainly 99%. So if you are really concerned about the dangers in modern life, you should campaign against the motor car. If you don't think that that's reasonable because you love your motor car, like most people do, why don't you think about staircases? The second major cause of accidental death in the United Kingdom is the staircase. People fall down the staircase and hit their heads on the bottom, either because they're drunk or because they can't see because it's dark. Why don't we do something about staircases and forbid them? Pass a law, no more staircases. This would save a lot of lives too. So I think really that if you're talking about saving human life, you must do it in proportion and be concerned about the major causes of human death rather than some cause which in fact has never killed anyone yet, namely the nuclear energy industry, which according to all statistics is about the safest industry there has ever been. Now I know some people are going to disagree with me, and I look forward to talking with them a little bit later on. Another point that I would like to make is that when we talk about our present world and the crises, the so-called crises of our present world, we always think of it in terms of our present knowledge. But this is a very wrong thing to do. We saw during the last World War, and we have seen at a lesser rate during the intervening years, that there are marvelous things to be discovered which we can't necessarily conceive of, but which turn up, which arrive. And why shouldn't something like that happen to help us? For example, if we had a superconductor which worked at room temperature so that we didn't lose any energy in transmitting electric power, we would certainly solve the immediate energy crisis. Is there any reason why we can't have a room temperature semiconductor? Our friends, the physicists, are unable to say it's impossible, and only partially able to tell us in which direction we, the chemists, ought to work. But I know that there are many organizations and many scientists, many chemists, who are interested by this problem. I wouldn't be surprised if we have a superconductor which works at, if not at room temperature, at least at a reasonably attainable temperature within the next 5 or 10 years. Let's look at another crisis, crisis of food. I think this is also an imaginary crisis. There was a meeting in Rome a few years ago which led to the most terrible predictions about how most of the world was going to starve within the next 20 years or before the end of the century. And I think this is absolutely not true. There is more than enough food in the world for everyone. There's a certain problem of distributing it, and some people die of starvation because they don't get the food properly distributed to them. But in a statistical sense, there is no shortage of food. And you must realize that even if we just applied the best standards of production, which pertain in Canada and in the United States, to the rest of the world, we'd have about three times as much food as we do now. So we could support three times the population. But this again supposes that there's nothing we can do, nothing we can invent to increase food production. I don't believe that for a moment. The chemists are always hard at work increasing the yields that we get, as also are the plant geneticists. And I think there's no reason to believe that we can't double the supply of food again. So we can surely make six times what we make at the present time without any problem at all. Now, there are also other ways which would be completely novel in which food could be produced. There are the so-called food yeasts, which are very efficient sources of hydrocarbons, very efficient utilizers of hydrocarbons. They convert hydrocarbons into food. You can calculate that a factory of just a few square miles working continuously with a supply, an infinite supply of hydrocarbon at a low cost, will be able to provide food for the whole of the world. Not perhaps the kind of food you'd want to eat, having regard to your upbringing, but nevertheless food which you would be glad to eat if you had to. In any case, the kind of food you eat is largely dependent on the kind of food that you ate when you were young. So I really don't think that this food crisis is a real one. It's an artificial crisis, which is partly created, of course, by the media. And I don't think the media should be exempt from blame in the kind of hysteria which is often generated in the world. The population crisis. It is, of course, related to the food crisis. We can't have more population than we have food to feed them. But I think also the population crisis is an artificial crisis. We have already all the technological methods at our disposal to control the rate of human reproduction. And indeed, in Europe and in North America, we see a good control of the rate of reproduction. The rate of increase in population is now not far from zero. The Japanese have set us an even better example. Since the last World War, the population of Japan has remained essentially constant. And even the Chinese, with their 800 million people, also set us a good example, thanks to the intensive propaganda and the help of Chairman Mao. The Chinese population has remained more or less the same during the last 10 years and shouldn't be increasing too rapidly in the future. There are some countries, of course, where for special reasons of religion or of social structure, it's much more difficult to control the population. But these are countries which I think must solve this problem for themselves. If the political authorities have the will, then I think the control can be developed. I have the feeling that the population in the end adjusts itself to the food supply without many people having to starve. It's a cause of automatic reflection of what is available to the population. Now let me talk a little bit about the economic crisis. The economic crisis has been getting worse recently. And certainly if you are unemployed, you believe that there is a real economic crisis. I'm not quite sure if it's a real crisis myself. People who are unemployed now are not in any way like the people who are unemployed in the 1930s. They have at least the minimal facilities with which to live. What causes the economic crisis of the present time? The economists certainly don't know. And I really don't think that economists, and I hope there are some of them here to disagree with me, are very much good to anybody. If the economists knew anything about economics, they would, of course, all be millionaires, because they would be able to predict the market. Now, of course, they're not all millionaires. I've noticed that professors of economics seem to live a little better than I do, but not so much better that they're millionaires. So I just conclude that they don't know what they're talking about. And if you actually get round to talking to them privately, they'll admit this. Now, what I would do, I mean, you may like to hear what I would do about all these things. So, what I would do if I were in control of the economy would be to propose that we return to the Bretton Woods Agreement. The Bretton Woods Agreement, you remember, was something which was signed towards the end of the last World War and controlled the world's economic relations between the end of the last World War until about 1964 or so, till when the Vietnam War became serious. It worked very well. Never before has the world grown so well, so rapidly, economically, and there was no reason, in my opinion, to end the Bretton Woods Agreement. What does the Bretton Woods Agreement mean? Now, I hope you won't think that I'm in any way anti-American, because I'm not. I've lived many years in the United States. I'm very friendly with all Americans. What the Bretton Woods Agreement specified was that there should be a relationship between the price of gold and the dollar, and that the dollar was interconvertible into other countries and into gold. That was what the basis of the Bretton Woods Agreement was. But when the Americans came to pay for the Vietnam War, they did it by printing money. Because they printed money, they eventually could no longer honor their obligation to convert the dollar into gold. Now, instead of doing what they should have done, what was inherent in the Bretton Woods Agreement, that is to double or increase dramatically the price of gold, they said, now gold is not money. Before, gold was money, but now it isn't money. It's just like any other commodity. And that's what we've lived with for the last 16 years or so, 14 years. I feel myself that the only way in which you can control inflation is by having some control over the printing of money, and that you can never trust a politician with this control, not in a democracy, because politicians want to be re-elected, they naturally make promises, and when they arrive in power, they find they can only fulfill these promises by printing money. Nothing stops them. So I'm afraid that I'm a very old-fashioned person in economic thinking. That is, I feel that if the President of the United States tomorrow signed a bill saying that he would buy and sell gold at $500 an ounce, the present economic crisis would speedily disappear. Well, that's something with which the professors of economics, if any are present, will be very happy to disagree and say that it is an absolutely scandalous suggestion. Do I have any crises left? Since I keep telling you they don't exist, they're imaginary, they're artificial, and so on. Yes, there is one real crisis. In one respect, the world is quite different from what it ever was before. And this comes from the existence of the nuclear bomb and the possibility, we hope not probability, of nuclear war. This is the real crisis to my mind. You can calculate, depending on how you read information that there are 100,000 or even a million nuclear devices in the world waiting to be exploded. If they were exploded, it would certainly kill the major part of the population, and it would leave the rest of the globe in a state where it might be difficult to conduct agriculture. We don't know. Certainly, what has happened is that the two superpowers of the world, the United States and the Soviet Union, are afraid about war. They don't want war anymore, because they realize that there could be no winner of a war. And it's this reason that we have had peace during the last 30 years. I talk about, I say peace. What I mean is that it's been a state of, in fact, not major war. The wars that we have had have been very minor ones. But you may well be concerned as to whether this can continue. In the past history of the human race, there's never been a time when you could be sure that war would not occur in the future, and I don't think that you could say make the same statement today. Something practical has to be done, and in particular it has to be done when one considers that a number of minor powers are all in their turn going to be able to make nuclear bombs. What should be done is, of course, something to debate. I personally believe that all the nations of the world have to give up a small amount of their sovereignty. National sovereignty to a nation is a kind of virility symbol that they've always had. They've never wanted to give up the slightest bit of it. But I think we have got to now consider how much of our national sovereignty we should give up in order to live permanently at peace with our neighbors. And I personally find what has happened in Europe since the last World War distinctly encouraging. The common market has come into existence. It was originally based on the hope that France and Germany could live together in peace and would never have to go to war together again. And the more the common market works, the more the states give up some of their sovereignty. Initially it's only been in trade, but now it looks like it's going to become a little bit, certain extent, in politics. The more this takes place, the less war can occur, and the safer is Western Europe. We can, I think, debate with each other how we could construct some kind of organization for all the nations of the world which would guarantee peace. Now, it can't be the United Nations. The United Nations is not a democratic body. Five powers have absolute veto authority over the deliberations of the many nations. And the many nations all have an equal vote, whether they're nations, mini nations of several hundred thousand people, or major nations with 50 or 100 million citizens. This is not the proper way in which to proceed. Let me say at once that I'm very happy to have the United Nations. It's a place where people can talk and discuss. That is good. But it is not in itself a world parliament, and the way it was set up, it never can be a world parliament. So how you set up about obtaining a world parliament which will give us laws which govern the control, the relationship of one nation to another, is something we can still debate. Now finally, I'd like to mention one other topic. Is there a political crisis in the world at the present time? Now I don't mean the kind of political crisis that you have in Canada, or that we in principle have in the United Kingdom, that is where France has as well, where various parts of the organization suddenly decide that they want to be separate. I'm not talking about that kind of political crisis. I'm talking about the political crisis which arises from the existence of communist states. When I was born, Soviet Union was born just about the same time. Soviet Union has survived. It has 250 million citizens. To the Soviet Union has been added the Chinese Republic of 800 million citizens, and we've added various other states, most of them rather small, some of them in Eastern Europe, so that now the part of the world, the proportion of the world, which has a communist government is about 1,500 million. That's almost about half the number of people that are living in the world at the present time. The nations of Western Europe and of North America, coupled with various other democracies, make up nearly the same number of citizens. Then we have states which are clearly fascistic in nature, which we need not consider further. But we clearly can see, if we look back over the last 50 years, a great expansion in the number of citizens who are in communist society versus the number of citizens who are living in a democracy. And I think we have to talk about this, we have to debate this. If we believe democracy is really the best way for mankind to live, the fairest way, where the individual citizen has the best relationship with the state, we ought to say so. Because it looks like, as a result of the economic crisis, that communist parties are going to come into power in Western Europe. And of course, once a communist party takes power, then the process is irreversible. Whatever they say, it becomes irreversible, and they become the state. Now, do we want this to happen or not? It's not a problem that faces Canada at this particular time. You have your other problem to worry about. But it's very much a problem that concerns France and Italy. And I would like to think that all the citizens of what we call the free world, all the citizens who live in democracies where if they don't like the government they can change it by voting, should be debating with each other what is the relationship between democracy and communism, and how can we make sure that democracy can survive, because it certainly won't survive if we don't talk about it. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, our speaker has indicated that he would welcome both comments and questions, so I think we should now throw the floor open for any which you may wish to address to him. Yes.
You began your talk this evening on the classification of crisis. You gave us three types: imaginary, the artificial, and the real. How do you distinguish between what is imaginary and what is artificial and what is real?
Well, by example, and I gave you
the question, some of
yes. The question is, how do I distinguish between imaginary, artificial, and real crises? And I said I do it by example, and that I've given you examples which illustrate what I say.
What I'm wondering is if the paper is convinced that in case of communist governments being elected in Italy and France, the democratic process would disappear. You implied that when you said it, but I'd like to say a little more on that.
Well, yes, of course, we have only precedent before us in Czechoslovakia, when the communist, when power was shared between the democratic parties and the communist party. After there came a certain moment when the communist party had power, control of the police force, and arbitrarily took over control of the whole country, and then declared that there would no longer be any democratic elections. That happened within our own time. It also happened, of course, in Poland and in Romania, but that was just at the end of the war.
I wish to make a comment. I did not hear a
better analysis and conclusion since I came from Czechoslovakia until this moment in this room.
Thank you, sir. He says that he never heard a better analysis of the situation since the time when he came from Czechoslovakia to this country. So I thanked him.
When the yellow fog was stopped and the acid rain maybe stopped and the foul Thames was reversed in the Rhine, I presume somebody must have drawn public attention to that. And I presume it wasn't the polluters. And I gathered that you denigrated the protesters about the Iranian threat, but it seems to me that in a democracy the public has to express the dangers they feel.
Yes, sir. The question, I don't think it's a question, it's a comment. The comment is that in a democracy the people who wish to protest about something which they feel is improper should do so. And of course I completely agree with that. I think that the proper way for protesters in a democracy is to write letters to the press, to the media, and to write letters to their representatives in Parliament, to attend any political meetings and to ask questions at the end of those political meetings. That's what real democracy is about. Ah, pardon.
Mr. Derrick, you mentioned that pollution was an imaginary crisis. Now, you also mentioned nuclear power as touched on as an imaginary crisis. What about the problem of nuclear waste, spent nuclear fuels? You said that there are no technological problems as far as pollution control goes. I'm under the impression there are no adequate methods of storage of waste nuclear fuels. What do you feel about that?
Well, I don't agree. Nuclear waste, since the question. The question is, are there adequate methods of storage of nuclear waste? And the questioner implies that he doesn't think there are, and I say that I don't agree. The reason why I don't agree is this, that we have been storing nuclear waste since the end of the Second World War. We've never had the slightest accident or problem with it. If it is of a medium level of radioactivity, you put it in concrete, in drums, and you bury it in the earth. If it is a high level of radioactive waste, it is stored in refrigerated steel tanks while we devise a method which will be more permanent. It's my understanding that this method of more permanency, which involves putting it into a glass, is essentially ready to be applied, and that then all kinds of nuclear waste will be stored safely deep in the earth in mines or other holes which already exist.
Well, you must read differently to what I do, because there have been accidents in the nuclear industry. There have been deaths, quite a few, because you have to take the whole field. You've got to start with uranium mines. There have also been deaths in the reactors, and right the way through. And we have not yet got these answers about the waste. And not only that, there have been accidents with these wastes. The seepage down in Hanford, California, going on every day.
Well, you see, you make a statement which is not supported. Question? The question is that there have been deaths in the nuclear energy industry caused by nuclear energy, and that there are leakages which have been going on for a long time. Well, now, you see, you make a statement, I make a statement, you're not an expert, I'm not an expert. I think it is a discussion of the deaf which we're having, and the only people who can really make a proper pronouncement about that are a committee of experts appointed by a democratically elected government. Such committees of experts have repeatedly pronounced that there is no danger, there have been no deaths, and if there is leakage it can be contained and detected and contained. So you see, we can never be in agreement. You and I. Please.
Sir Derrick, have you ever heard the term captive scientist?
A captive scientist. Well, I hope he's captive to truth. This is what a scientist should be captive to.
That's not what the term means.
Well, the question is, have I heard about captive scientists? And I say that, to my mind, a captive scientist is a scientist who is captive to truth, which is the only thing that matters for a scientist. Now, would you like to amplify further?
It's usually used about scientists who work for government and industry,
mm-hmm.
and give to the media and the public misinformation.
Well, that's...
Democracies can interfere into political structure of another country, you know, by protests, not by war, by protests.
What do I think we should do about democracy and in promote? How should we strengthen democracy, and how should we make our opinions opposed about the make our opinions known about the Helsinki conference? Well, I think we can only strengthen democracy if we appreciate democracy. If we talk about it, we look at what the alternatives are, and we say to ourselves that really, although democracy has its faults, it is so much better and fairer than any other form of society that we must struggle for it. Now, I agree with you, this doesn't mean that we're going to fight wars. What it means is that we're going to write letters, and that in particular we're going to write letters, say, to the Russian ambassador. Why don't we write the Russian ambassador in Ottawa 100,000 letters telling him what we think about what he's done to Levitch, for example? That's the way in which democracy should work, and that we should try to enforce the Helsinki principles. Well, there are certain...
Is there a moral crisis in the world?
No, I don't think so. But of course, that is a personal opinion. I am not a strongly religious person. I suppose if I were a strongly religious person, I would reply to you and say yes. But I think if you're a religious person, a strongly religious person, there has always been a moral crisis in the world. You have always felt that the majority of citizens have not been sufficiently moral. Please. The question is, do I feel that genetic engineering and work like that in biology, molecular biology, I guess, is constitutes a crisis? I don't think so, no, because in fact nature has been doing just this kind of genetic engineering ever since the microbes appeared upon the earth. The microbes have been swapping their DNA around ever since they appeared, and long before we appeared. And I doubt whether we're going to do anything worse than nature has already done over many, many millions of bacterial lives, billions of bacterial lives.
What is your view of the fact that there is a belief politicians?
The question is, do I feel that democracies today suffer from a crisis of leadership, that we no longer have leaders of adequate integrity and no doubt intelligence, etc.? Well, I don't know. I think that we have the usually the best leaders that are available, and if you think they're not good enough, then I think it's the duty of the citizen who thinks they are not good enough to step forward himself and say, look, I'm much better, why don't you elect me? I really don't see how you can select your leaders except by the processes that we have now. They're not such bad leaders, they do their best, some of them are really quite bright. I want them to be honest and moral. That's the thing that I really think is important.
Would you include the commerce in that category?
No, I don't. We don't. We've never had any economist politicians. They don't go into politics. Well, Harold Wilson left economics such a long, long time ago that I don't think he counts. Paul Douglas, I don't know anything about him. Anyway, it was only a joke, so don't take it too seriously. Someone at the back, yes.
It seems to me that your classifications of imaginary, real, and artificial are quite narrow, if indeed, as you say, democracy is really the state. Perhaps I think the more democratic classifications might be those crises over which the individual has control, such as staircases and cars, and those crises over which the individual is powerless, such as nuclear war, pollution, or living in an agriculturally depressed area.
Yes, the statement is, I think it's not a... It's not a question. I think the statement is that there are two kinds of crises, those over which the individual has some kind of control and those over which the individual does not have a control. Now, certainly over nuclear war, the individual only has any kind of control by anticipating what might happen and electing the right kind of people. I don't admit that the individual has no control over some of the other crises about which I was talking, because in a democracy he has the duty and the obligation to express himself to the right people. So when it's a matter of we're disagreeing about what is democracy. Yes. Please?
Perhaps the last question would accept that there's a middle possibility, the crisis over which we think we don't have control.
The suggestion is that these are crises over which we think we don't have any control, but in fact if we work at it, we do have some measure of control.
One of the real crises you said was the nuclear weaponry.
Yes.
Potentially could destroy that.
Yes.
Complain without any reasons. First of all, how students could trust scientists or people like those who live on British Islands who cleaned their air but sent it up to Sweden and don't pay for it. That's one thing. And I think as old people we have to trust young and do give them something. And I think we don't do anything for young people. We leave them polluted air. We treat them with and we you even don't promise them a good life. Just threat from the nuclear destruction.
Yes. I think the statement is that we don't do enough for the young people. I don't agree with that. I think that the young people have never had better chances in life than they have now. All they have to do is to do some work. Now, when I was a young man, it didn't matter how hard you worked, you could well be in a situation where you didn't have the chance to express yourself because you didn't have the excellent facilities now that we now have of social security and things like that. So I don't agree that the young are in any way underprivileged at the present time relative to what they were in the past. Now, also another thing that we have done for the young, which is important, is to reduce the age at which they can participate in elections. I'm not sure if this applies to Canada, but at least in the United Kingdom, the age at which you vote has been reduced from 21 to 18. The same in France, too. And this means that really people who are biologically very young, I think, can now go and vote in the democratic process. There's no reason why they shouldn't campaign for people of their own age if they so wish. What more can we do for the young?
They don't have jobs, they don't have any responsibility, and whenever they vote for something or want something, we just push them down.
Well, now, that's an, The proposition is that the young require jobs and that we are somehow suppressing them by not giving them jobs. Of course, I regret very much that in the present economic crisis, not all young people find it easy to get jobs. In fact, some of them persistently don't get jobs. But this is different from the situation since the war. It's not at all different from the situation before the war that I remember. And my opinion is, from my own experiences with the young at the present time in the university, is that all those people who have ability and are really prepared to work will find jobs. The people who don't get jobs are those who are lazy, that's one category, or not gifted, which is regrettably another category, and those who think that they deserve a much better job than that is available for them at the present time. That, of course, is unkind, perhaps.
Earlier, that as far as France and Italy were concerned, there was a possibility that the Communist parties might achieve office.
Yes.
I sense from your remarks that you consider this something of a crisis.
Well, I said in parentheses, is there a political crisis? Yes? Is this a question or a statement?
My question is, how would you propose going about dealing with what constitutes a crisis in this situation?
Well, I think again that this is a crisis which democracy is facing, and I see it happening in France, of course. This is why I'm concerned about it. And really, people in a democracy have got to find out what are the alternative forms of society. Clearly, communism is an alternative form of society. It exists already for 1,500 million people. We can go and look at it. We can read books about it. We know what kind of a society it is. It is a highly disciplined society. Those who are members of a communist state don't have very much freedom to disagree with the government. Now, we want to say this. We want to know this. And we want to decide, do we want to have a disciplined society where there is no unemployment, or would we rather have a less disciplined society where we can change the government if we want to, and where we have the freedom to criticize the government or any other agency for that matter whenever we wish? That's the sort of thing we have to decide. In addition, of course, I would like to say that in a democracy, the average standard of living is much higher. If that's something that you think important, I think you should also discuss that.
So after being inconsistent in arguing that the proliferation of nuclear weapons is a real crisis, but that the proliferation of nuclear energy is the solution, or one of the options to the energy shortage,
The question is, am I not illogical in saying that the real crisis in the world is the proliferation of nuclear weapons, and that there is no crisis where the application of nuclear energy is concerned? No, I don't agree that. I'm not really so concerned about the proliferation of nuclear weapons as the use of nuclear weapons, of course. That is the real danger. It doesn't matter what arms you have. If you never use them, then they're just ornaments. So I'm not so much concerned about proliferation as the use. Now, I don't agree that the application of nuclear energy increases the danger of the use of nuclear weapons, or that terrorists will get hold of nuclear material and make bombs. Because if the terrorists really want to make bombs, all they have to do is to go around to their local army depot and borrow one that has already been made. They're there, there are 100,000 or 1 million of them, depending on how you count. I don't agree about that. Please?
To follow up on this last point, you've listed quite a few crises. individually, what you say, may well make sense, but surely they all interact with one another. Surely the food crisis interacts with the energy shortage, and the economic crisis, and the potential political crisis, and then the potential nuclear weapons one. Surely they all interact, and surely we see no signs, or very few signs, of our government dealing sensibly with them. So while individually there may not be, there may be imaginary crisis, what do you say about them all put together?
What do I say about the proposition that all crises interact with each other, and therefore it's not a proper logical process to separate them? Well, yes, of course they do interact with each other, but if I didn't make the proposition that you could make separate analyses of the crises, I wouldn't be able to come before you this evening and present my thesis to you. We wouldn't have this talk.
Discussing political crises, you mentioned the possible crises of the communist world versus non-communist world. Do you see any kind of crisis at all in the non-communist world, in the non-industrialized countries, and they're approaching the kind of standard of living which we have in Western Europe and North America, and are providing them with a problem, with a solution to that problem?
Yes, well, of course, the developing countries of the world, or if you like, the underdeveloped countries, as we used to call them, do not constitute a major proportion of the world's population. So if we're going to count heads, then they are not such an important problem as the problem of the relationship between democracy and communism. Now, I think that the poor countries of the world certainly must be helped, but I think they must be helped by educational opportunity rather than simply by providing food or other material resources. No person, and certainly I don't think any nation, likes to be given something without having worked for it, having justified receiving it. And I think what we have to do for the developing countries is to provide them with education of the kind that they really need. And that doesn't mean high-powered scientists and people like that. It means highly skilled craftsmen and highly skilled people lower down in the ladder of educational opportunity. Please. In what category of crisis would I put all the world's political prisoners? Well, of course, I am entirely opposed to the world having any political prisoners. And it depends on how you define a political prisoner. For example, are all the people who work in the work camps in the Soviet Union and in China, are they political prisoners? Or are they just misled citizens who need re-education by work? You have to define that.
Those who have been arrested are political prisoners.
All right. Well, in that case, most of the political prisoners of the world are in communist society because they've been arrested. Yes, their ratio is tens of thousands to one. That doesn't mean there aren't political prisoners in Western society, I suppose. But I really don't see how a democracy can have political prisoners, because you are not arrested in a democracy for protesting. And it doesn't matter what you say or what you write, you're not going to be arrested. Yes, but the comment is that Latin America has many hundred political prisoners. I agree, but they're not democracies. No. So, I mean, they go along with the communist states, in my opinion. They are authoritarian states where you can't change the government by election.
Except that they are rightists and not leftists.
Well, I dislike both of them independently. I don't think that either are very meritorious. Please, the back.
Process, and I don't think any of us actually think there's going to be a referendum on whether to use the nuclear weapons. process to be involved in at all. If you really can think there will be a referendum over use, perhaps half the world might have a chance of expressing itself, but I can only doubt that.
Yes, I think the comment is, this is not a question, is it? This is a comment that we won't have the chance to say whether we want to use nuclear weapons or not via referendum, because it would take too long. And of course that's correct. There's going to be only about 10 or 15 minutes. That's not enough time. I don't see what you can do about it. Okay, so therefore, if this is correct, then what we should be concerned about is proliferation and preventing proliferation. I would agree that we should not in any way encourage other nations to have nuclear weapons. But nevertheless, you must accept that in the real world, a nation tends to think that it is not safe unless it has nuclear weapons. And in the presence, perhaps, yes, the proposition that no nation is safe when there are nuclear weapons, a perfectly correct proposition. But nevertheless, individual nations don't feel like that. Individual nations feel they're only safe if they have some way to defend themselves. And this, of course, is the paradox. Until you have a proper way of not governing the world, but controlling what goes on in the world by some kind of world assembly, you're never going to get away from this paradox, the one you mentioned.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure we could go on practically indefinitely addressing ourselves to these crises, given that it has been raised that we might shortly be destroyed by a meteorite. And however remote that possibility may be, I would not like to take place until we have had an opportunity to thank Sir Derek Barton for his talk this evening. And I would like to call on Dr. Dennis Vance to thank him on our behalf.
Although I have not met Professor Barton previously, I have known of his major contributions to our understanding of the shape or conformation of steroid molecules since my first course in biochemistry. Yet, we cannot directly measure the impact of his research on science and medicine, even though it's taught in the first year course in biochemistry. It is the fundamental knowledge that is derived from basic research, such as performed by Professor Barton and his colleagues, that provides the foundation upon which advances are made that directly benefit our health and welfare. However, scientists do sometimes evaluate each other's relative merits by citing the number of research papers that are published from a person's laboratory. In the period between 1970 and 1974, for example, the approximate number of citations per average scientist would probably be less than about 50. In this same five-year period, the work of Professor Barton and his colleagues was cited approximately 2,700 times. As we've seen tonight, Professor Barton does not limit his interest to the imaginary crises of chemistry. From his lecture this evening, we have gained new insight into the various types of smoldering crises, some of which loom ominously. As in scientific research, we cannot hope to deal effectively with these problems until we understand the nature of them. It is only then that a logical approach can be developed by which we can solve these crises. Hence, we are indebted to Professor Barton for helping us to understand what the real crises are. This is the first step to the solution of these difficult problems. Thus, on behalf of the Vancouver Institute and the audience, I should like to express our gratitude to you for sharing with us your optimism and insight this evening. Thank you very much, Professor Barton.